Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation to talk, and welcome, and thanks for coming. So hopefully I will get to some of the newer stuff, and apologies to those of you that might know some of the introductory material, but I wasn't sure exactly about the audience. I'm assuming there's a mixture of people in terms of whether you've seen the extended gravitational thermodynamics or not. And so I'll spend some time just setting the context and telling you essentially a little bit of a five-year journey of me trying to figure out exactly what it's good for. And the outcome is that I at least have found one or two very sharp places where this is useful in the context of holography and through that to quantum information. So that's the punchline. But let's do a little bit of history. So hopefully this will be visible. This is my way of writing on the blackboard without writing on the blackboard. So let me tell you a quick sketch of the gravitational thermodynamics. And I apologize, if some of this is extremely basic. So of course, let's start out with just vacuum Einstein's equations and consider some typical black hole solution. And of course, as we know, there's a long and beautiful history involving understanding through various techniques, which sometimes go under the name of semi-classical quantum gravity, the thermodynamics associated with the black hole. So I'm just going to sort of run through some of the basic things. This is more or less just going to set my notation. So I have some horizon radius, or Schwarzschild radius in this case. Some area, some surface gravity I can compute, and once I get going, then I can compute the Hawking temperature. Just in green there, I've reminded you of the units, but we'll mostly be setting all of those things to one. The Hawking temperature and the entropy, and of course that, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, and in some ways that's the birth of that's the foundation of the whole program of black hole thermodynamics. And there's a nice map that associates properties of the black hole on the gravity side to some thermodynamic systems properties. So I have the internal energy mapping to the mass and the area, the entropy, as I said, the surface gravity, temperature. And so I have something, some analog then of the first law, that in this language assembles itself into the usual first law of thermodynamics. And of course, one of the interesting, and then of course there's the second law, the non-decreasing nature of the area in various property in various processes corresponds to the non-decreasing of the entropy. So there's the second law of thermodynamics, and that's of course beautiful, and many of you have probably written umpteen papers doing this in other examples, and maybe this is familiar to a lot of you. And if it's not familiar to you, well, just take this as our starting point of the discussion. So one of the things you might think about if you were presenting this to in an undergraduate class for whatever reason. I think, in fact, the typical undergraduate class would think this is a bit of an odd setup, because some of the most natural variables that you usually have in thermodynamics are also a pressure and a volume, and that's manifestly missing from the standard black hole thermodynamics. There are other things that often play the role of pressure and volume to go together to make a PdV-like term. The standard work terms that might be associated with angular momentum and angular velocity, or charge and potential. But I'm talking now about real work, you know, a real P and a real V, as it were. So one of the really nice things that happened recently, although it's quite some years now, I'll give you the reference, is that there is a way of turning that on that gives you what you might think of as the natural thermodynamics that you would sort of see in an undergraduate class. And so, of course, as you know from general relativity, there is something that plays a natural role of a pressure, and that's a cosmological constant. So we can turn that on. So far, I've had that turned off. So I'd add on the left-hand side, for example, a lambda times g mu nu. And of course, we could take that over to the other side and think of it in terms of some fluid with a certain energy density given by rho there, or with a pressure. And the equation of state is rho equals minus p. And so this is presumably all reasonably familiar from GR. And so the question would be then, let's pretend for whatever reason, and let's not worry about where that comes from right now, but let's pretend for some reason that the pressure, the cosmological constant, is actually dynamical. It's allowed to be a dynamical variable in the theory. So now I have the full dynamics of the pressure to play with in the story. And so where are we in the thermodynamics if we were to think of it in those terms, if we were allowed that to happen? So you must go back and redo some of the things you would do normally, redo the mass formula, and this is very schematic. And if you were to allow the cosmological constant to vary and organize things in the right way, after a bit, you will find that you can write down something that looks like this. So I've just made those substitutions. That's my assignment for the pressure. And whatever's left over, I'm going to call the volume. And so I end up writing something like this. So that's essentially the first law of thermodynamics in these new variables. But you're used to thinking of the first law, of course, in terms of those variables, du equals Tds minus Pdv. And so you see that actually the mass of the black hole, just rearranging, the mass of the black hole is now not the internal energy alone, but there's a Pv that turns that Vdp into a minus Pdv. And so that's, if you were in a chemistry class, you'd go, oh, of course, that's the enthalpy. So that's sort of interesting. And what does that all mean? So let's talk about that for a little while. And I'll give you the reference for that in a moment. This isn't changing. Ah, there it is, right. So that was this was way back in 2009, Castelray and Trashin, a really lovely paper where they did some of these steps a lot more carefully than I did just now. This is essentially just a sketch of what they did. So that's very nice. Let's think about it a little bit more. So what happened to the map? Well, the map has changed now. I have mass, area, and surface gravity, but the mass now goes to the enthalpy. The area and the surface gravity still tell us about a temperature and an entropy. And then I also now have cosmological constant, which is a pressure. And I can also get the volume by varying the enthalpy with respect to the pressure in the usual way. So this is all either very familiar or pleasantly familiar or horrifyingly familiar, depending upon whether you liked your undergraduate thermodynamics class or not. Maybe you hoped you'd never see the enthalpy ever again. Well, here it is. Okay, so and I'll use this a lot later on, right? Remembering that in some ways the natural variables, from the supergravity perspective, I have some solution with a mass, so that's natural in some sense, more natural, if you like, than the internal energy. So I really should be working in terms of the entropy. Its natural variables are pressure and entropy, as written here. And so the temperature and volume can think of as derived quantities given some computation of the mass, derived quantities that I can get by varying h in that way. And so we can even do an example. But first, let's just talk a little bit about the enthalpy. What's the enthalpy? Right, it was that thing, something to do with chemistry and volumes, environments, and things like that. The way to think about it is that I should keep track not just of the internal energy of some process or some system or in some chemical reaction, maybe the sum of all of those things. But I should also compensate by the cost to occupy the volume that this this system takes up. So what does that mean in this case? All right, and I'm obliged to draw a piston and a, you know, again, traditional undergraduate class mnemonics. Let's do a computation. Let's go back to Schwarzschild. Let's do ADS and let's do an assignment where I pick out in a conventional way what the natural length scale, little l, is corresponding to that cosmological constant. It'll be easier to write things in those terms. So the pressure is that minus lambda over 8 pi g becomes this. And so you can write down the Schwarzschild solution in ADS and it looks like this. And you can compute where the horizon is. You can work out what the mass is in terms of the horizon radius. These are all standard, very simple kindergarten algebra, so I'm not spending too much time on it. I can write the mass in terms of the horizon radius as such, and the entropy, and so on and so forth. And one way or other of computing the temperature will give you an expression for the temperature. So let me not dwell on that. It's a fairly standard calculation, nothing new to see here. But now I want to think of it in this new setup. What does it look like? I take that mass formula and I say, well, really that's the enthalpy according to what we saw. So I should write it in terms of its natural, I should basically just change variables and write it in terms of S and P, its natural variables, in preparation for then being able to do the variations that we talked about. So if I vary that with respect to S and do the algebra, and for some reason I've written out every step, I have no idea why, I get the temperature formula that I had on the previous page. And so that's nice. That's a sort of self-consistency check. I give myself a gold star. And now the new thing would be to get the volume by varying H with respect to P, keeping S fixed, see what happens in that case. And so off you go. And similarly, overkill on the steps. And oh, well, that's interesting. It's the obvious thing, which is sort of nice. Although at the same time also sort of a bit strange, because we're not really supposed to think of a black hole as a ball of radius r, certainly not coming out from in, because you know r isn't really the radius and so on and so forth. But the from the point of view of this black hole being in the system, and if you like coming integrating from out up to that space, up to that horizon, it really is as though you've cut out a ball of radius RH, and the volume of that thing is what it turns out to be, the thermodynamic volume. So that's rather cute and actually very, very interesting. And so, and it fits completely with the enthalpy idea. Because if you think about it, I have, if I think about the space-time before, I just have empty ADS with some cosmological constant, and hence some energy density rho, given thus. And so the cost of cutting out that volume should be rho times v, and that's precisely what we saw. Sorry, I jumped forward a little bit, but that was essentially what we that volume is indeed the natural volume that it should be in order to interpret the enthalpy appropriately. So it's a surprising result for the reasons I just said, and it turns out it's special for static black holes. It turns out for other kinds of space-times, non-static, the naive geometrical volume isn't the thermodynamic volume isn't always the naive geometrical volume, and there's a number of papers on that that I think there's probably more since I wrote this slide. And there's a couple of really nice reviews as well. So this is an interesting issue, but let's move on. For our purposes, we will not be in this non-geometrical regime, so it doesn't matter. Okay, so I'm going to tell you what I first started doing and what led me to where we are now by taking a little bit of a detour. And so I'm going to tell you about a fun thing, or at least I think it's a fun thing, called a holographic heat engine. Because, of course, one of the things we do, again, going back to traditional thermodynamics, and of course going back to the foundations of thermodynamics in the 19th century, was think about heat engines. In some sense, they were the driver for trying to understand thermodynamics. So what do I mean by heat engine? I really mean a system by which I can take it through a cycle and do real mechanical work. So I'm going to use those PV terms. So this is something that we could not have done with black holes prior to this setup, because there were no PV terms. So now so there's a whole new kind of black hole heat engine, which is different from the business of coming up with engines that do work through, for example, electromagnetic terms in the context of, say, astrophysics. This is sort of completely different, and in some ways it's also completely artificial, because I don't have a varying cosmological constant, certainly not in our universe. But I think it's an interesting exercise. And I'll tell you why I think it's a sharp thing to construct and wonder what its properties might teach us. So let's construct a black hole heat engine. And so again, we go back to, you know, whenever you first did heat engines as a fun or perhaps not fun things to play with back in undergraduate physics. And what you do is you have a diagram like this. I have a traditional heat engine, which means that I take in some amount of heat from a reservoir. I exhaust some amount of heat to a cold reservoir, a hot reservoir, and in exchange I get some work done. And by necessity, I must have some exhaust. Second law of thermodynamics puts a limit on the efficiency. And as you know, there's a famous limit on the efficiency that follows from the second law. As you know, it's the Carnot efficiency, which we'll talk about in a second. But let me just remind you of some of the construction. So I draw a PV diagram, for example. I don't have to. It's a closed loop in there. That's the engine going through a cycle. Along that cycle, there's some net heat flow according to the labelings I've given here, and I get some work out, which is just the area of that region there. So the efficiency is bang for your buck. How much work do you get out for the heat that you put in? And I can write it in various ways. And let me jump immediately to the general setup, which would be that I have I'm taking some working substance through the cycle, and given an equation of state, I can just write down, I can compute that efficiency for any substance. And the key difference here, the real input from the real input from gravity, is that the equation of state is given to us by a black hole. And it essentially comes from that temperature equation I wrote down before, which if you read it right, you know, from a black hole perspective, it is, there's the temperature as a function of horizon radius, and there's some cosmological constant contribution coming in. But the way to read it now is that, remember, I should trade in that L squared for a P, and so this really, and that R for a V, and so that is a PVT curve, an equation of state that we could write down. So that's an example of how you might write it. And so I have a series of curves, and I could, in principle, build a heat engine, do some cycle, and carry on. So this is very interesting. I haven't given you any examples yet. I can't remember if I worked one out. Might not be necessary, because I don't want to dwell on that aspect right now. I want to think about why this might be interesting. So it's a fun game. It's certainly, at the very least, you can now, those of you who teach, you can now use it as a is a new way of generating new exam questions for undergraduate thermodynamics, because you have a whole new way of getting exact equations of state that you can use to do fun things. But there's also, if you like, a more serious application I want to think about, which is holography. And the point is that precisely when I have positive pressure, where everything sort of makes traditional sense, I have negative cosmological constant. And as we know in that case, ADS gravitational physics should be dual to some non-gravitational field theory in one dimension fewer. So all of this stuff I've been doing ought to have some interpretation in that context. Moreover, one would go as far as to say that it must be true that important things we might discover about the gravitational physics in this extended gravitational sense ought to translate into important statements about what's going on in some dual holographic theory. So that was my thought back in 2014 when I first encountered this whole extended thermodynamics setup. And the history there is sort of fun. I began to notice a little jump in citations of an old paper I wrote with Rob Myers and collaborators, where we worked out the thermodynamics of charged black holes and discovered this lovely van der Waals phase transition picture. And then I began to notice that people were getting interested in it again, and it was due to this paper by Kubiznak and Mann. I don't know if they're here. Oh, hi, finally we meet. I don't know if David is here.
It's gonna be a tutorial.
Oh, okay, right. But so they did this beautiful, I was gonna say beautiful even before I knew you were here. Wrote this beautiful paper where they recast that work I did with Rob and Chamberlain and Emperan in this extended framework, and saw that it wasn't just that you had a van der Waals-like family of phase transitions. If you go in and in this extended framework, work out the details, work out the critical exponents, et cetera, it maps exactly to van der Waals on the nose, which is a really beautiful observation. So that was what, I had no idea about this lovely paper from 2009 on the extended thermodynamics until I read theirs. But my first thought was, well, why has no one applied this to holography? It's begging to be applied to holography. So that was what set me on this path. And then the thought, so the usual holographic picture. Let me move on. It's a black hole in ADS, dual field theory. I said all the words already. And then it occurred to me that this might be very interesting for the following reason. Somehow on that, following that map through, each point on the plane, on the PV plane, is some dual field theory, just following it through qualitatively. Doing a loop then would correspond to somehow visiting, doing a tour in the space of field theories, and calculating the efficiency of that heat engine, which I remind you is, I went too fast. Let me see, maybe I have the same thought here. Okay, no, I'm gonna go back because I need to make that. Nope, not challenges. One more. Yeah. The thought then would be that, for example, the fact that the efficiency of a heat engine tour in the space of field theories is bounded by the Carnot efficiency ought to mean something. All right? You know, my feeling being that I find this very naturally defined dimensionless number that has a bound on it. That screams something important in field theory, and the question is what? And so that really sort of what led me on this path of trying to understand whether properties of heat engines can teach us something about the space of field theories. So that's sort of, all of this is by way of introduction, and lots of interesting things were done along the way. You can do lots of interesting things with various kinds of black holes, computer efficiencies, design clever formulae for computing efficiencies of heat engines with in principle very complicated cycles and things like that. So that was what occupied me and a few others for some years.
But, I don't know if this is a good point to ask. It
may be.
Uh-huh. You're talking about a dynamical lambda there, uh-huh. and saying it's an RG flow, but usually the RG flow is in space, isn't it, coming in from the boundary. So you rarely have a genuinely dynamical lambda where your cosmological constant is changing right on the boundary as well.
Not sure what you mean by genuine, but I may. Oh, actually, I don't. Okay, good. I killed the slide where I talked a little bit about that.
In cosmology, you genuinely have an evolving lambda in inflation.
Right.
You change your lambda.
Good.
So you have a flow there, but that's a timeline flow, whereas your RG flow tends to be in terms of spatial flow from the UV to the IR.
That's great. And so that's exactly what I have in mind. So the slide I deleted to save time was precisely talking about the fact that it is not unreasonable that we're in the right context to make this work, because we do have the example of holographic RG flow. And so the scalars in some generalized supergravity theory do indeed allow you to dynamically change the cosmological constant.
Change lambda, but dynamical suggests sort of an evolution in time, so that in the black hole vicinity, as you go in time, you're changing your local lambda. So it's not a change from UV to IR. It's not a sort of change in space, but a change in time. This is one thing that's always puzzled me with these.
But that's just because I think to actually solve the equations, people have chosen to write it that way. But in principle, I have fully dynamical scalars which have time dependence. That I can turn on their dynamics, and at least with a reasonable separation of scales, I can say that they're supplying me some effective dynamics, which may be time dependent if I chose to find such solutions.
So I'm envisaging fixing the boundary, so you've got like L fixed near the boundary, and then in the interior of the space-time, you're starting off at 1L, you're cranking the handle, going to a different L where you now have an RG flow, and then doing some other, part of your square, and then eventually going back to the original constant.
I see no reason why such solutions can't exist.
Okay, but that's what you've got in mind.
It's among one of the many things I have in mind. There's the issue of what one has in mind and what's actually computable. And so that's the difficulty. Yeah, and that's the difficulty. Your comment about the known examples not having a time dependence isn't because you can't do that. It's just because no one's written down the solutions.
Okay.
Yeah. in some sense, I think I'll get to this at some point where I mumble about the annoyance of wanting to be able to explore more the natural conjecture, but it's all in places where one can't compute until last year. So for reasons that might seem random, because of a slide I deleted for speed, I'm now going to just take a step aside and tell you something about quantum information, because it was in the title and you came expecting, so I should deliver. So a quick review of entanglement entropy would go along the following lines. And so I have in mind some quantum system, which may be in higher dimensions, but for the ease of writing, let's just make it a line. And I have some subregion there over which I wish to, in some sense, separate out from the rest of the space-time. And so if I take, for example, the vacuum and compute the reduced density matrix by tracing out all the other degrees of freedom, I have this natural object, which I'm sure you've had many talks on, called the entanglement entropy, which is defined a la von Neumann or Shannon, depending upon which direction you came from. So that's sort of an interesting quantity. And one of the really wonderful things about holography in the last many, many years has been, it has supplied a very, very nice way of computing this in regions where, especially in field theories, where it's either very difficult or nigh impossible to actually compute using field theory methods. One of the things that's very interesting about it is that it helps provide a generalization of something that's considered very important in field theory and very important in the whole business of discussing RG flow, which are C theorems, which tells you there's some measure of degrees of freedom of the theory that decrease along an RG flow in the following way. So I'm at the UV, I go to the IR, and I have a relationship like this. So there's some C function, which generalizes the Zamological C function, which is non-decreasing in this way. And by the way, which is always, people always mumble, it reminds you of the second law of thermodynamics, but it's sort of an analogy. We'll come back to that. From the point of view of computation, I'm gonna very quickly and perhaps annoyingly point to three different perspectives for how you compute, how you might compute this in a particular setup. And a lot of the work that I'm going to rely on was actually done here by Cassini, Huerta, and Myers. So I have what I actually, in this case, I'm going to use. I'm in flat space, and I have a conformal field theory, and I'm going to reduce it on a ball of radius r, which I think I have some notation for that. And I'll be in d spacetime dimensions. And oops, that wasn't supposed to happen. Sorry, something got shifted. And I have... Oh, I see. That's why. And so there are a number of ways one can compute. So probably the most famous way is to use the Ru Takanayaki perspective that tells you that if I now think of this d-dimensional field theory with the ball, I make it a two-dimensional slice for the purposes of being able to draw a picture, and now it's that circle there. I compute the minimal surface that extends for static spacetimes out into the full ADS that is dual to this story. And the entropy will turn out to be, after regularization that I'll tell you about, the area of that minimal surface divided by 4g. The second way of going is to go in a different direction. So I'm still getting used to this pointer. There we go. And it turns out you can compute the area of what is essentially a hyperbolically sliced ADS space. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. It naturally comes with a horizon, if you like, that is also, you can compute the area over 4G with an appropriate regularization, and you'll get the same answer. Or if you were sophisticated enough, you could actually do the direct field theory computation in principle and get the answer as well. So alpha, beta, gamma are the three methods you could use to compute the same quantity for the entanglement entropy. And the reason option gamma works so nicely, as observed by CHM, is the fact that you can actually use a conformal transformation that maps that reduced state to a thermal state in a there's the reference in case you want to look it up, in a if you like, in a toy auxiliary theory, in which case, and then you have, so you then have this thermal state with some appropriate Hamiltonian, which is, we won't really need its details, but there's some temperature, which is 1 over 2 pi times the radius of the ball that we talked about. So there's this other computation that you can work in, and it's essentially this hyperbolic, it's sort of a Rindler-like space with that temperature. And so if you could compute the entropy for that field theory, you can you're ending up computing, because the entropy is invariant under that conformal transformation, you can get the answer. And then what they observed was that I can use then the methods of ADS-CFT to map that computation to a simple area computation in some hyperbolically sliced ADS. So that's sort of how that map works. And so you can compute this. And the actual computation boils down to one calculation, the same calculation in all from all perspectives. And it really is that you know the area of that Ryu Taganiaki surface is infinite. The area of that hyperbolically sliced horizon in ADS is infinite. And so there's a regularization you must do. You essentially get this integral, one way or another, of doing the computation. And there's some numbers there that I'll tell you what they are. And then you basically take the integral out to some, you regularize it. It's a field theory result. The entropy is, by definition, a quantity that needs regularization for you to then pull out what the interesting universal pieces are in this way. So let me just show you some of the pieces. The details don't matter if you've not seen this before. I'll pull out the important bits for you. This is basically just a bit of geometry. There's a d-2 sphere who's of radius 1, whose volume is that. So that's a bunch of gamma functions, and there's a bunch of gamma functions and pi's there. There's a quantity there I'm calling AD star, following their notation. And I'll tell you what that does, or what that is in a moment. And depending upon whether you're in D odd or even, the result will calculate, there's a typical what's called the area law, which goes with some area that's given like this, just combining that omega with r to some power. There's the cutoff, which I'm calling epsilon. I'll tell you how the cutoff works in a moment. And then there's some subleading terms, and then at the end you get some universal terms, which are indeed the thing that is in some sense most detailed, details independent. So why is this nice? Because A, which I've given you here, which depends on this L here, is essentially like the radius R. It's sort of the one length scale in the problem. And then there's G Newton and a bunch of numbers. This thing here is essentially the generalization to D dimensions of Zamolodchikov's C function for our d-dimensional conformal field theory. And so it comes in the entropy in this nice way. And so in some sense, the entropy is this nice package that carries this thing around. So being able to follow things like the C theorem, et cetera, does boil down to following things like the entanglement entropy or quantities that are related to it. So that's sort of, there's a little bit of a mouthful here, but the key thing is that the entropy, after appropriate regularization, and here's the regularization here. There's some cutoff epsilon that goes into the maximum size of how far out you go in this infinite volume. And after doing that, it will pick out this nice number for you, or family of numbers. So what we're going to do is keep track of where these numbers show up in a story that I'm going to switch to right now. But here's the key observation. I stumbled on the CHM paper by accident. I was looking at something else. But then I noticed something, which is that that method we just talked about is a computation in gravitational thermodynamics. It's a computation in gravitational thermodynamics at finite temperature. But it tells me about properties in non-thermal field theory. So it's telling me about quantum information theories. Now, what I'd been looking for is some place where I could relate the gravitational thermodynamic, the extended gravitational thermodynamics, which I described to you the first time round in the first part of the talk, which is at finite temperature. And so it's hard to make statements about in ADS CFT precisely where a lot of the things you'd want to compute are at finite temperature, and it's hard to make sense of exactly how to answer some of those questions about things I might compute in extended thermodynamics and some holographic field theory. But here we have a setup where I have a gravitational thermodynamics that computes things in a non-thermal theory. So all of a sudden there's an opportunity here. So that's what got me very excited a couple of years ago. And then I found a way of putting it all together. So the key thing clearly is to work out the extended gravitational thermodynamics of this of this stuff. And the point there is that the hyperbolically sliced ADS is in fact just one member of a large family of solutions which are hyperbolic black holes. And so what we need to do is extended thermodynamics of hyperbolic black holes. So that's the next thing I'm going to do. And then by the time I'm done with that, we'll be able to put the whole story together. And you'll finally see, I think, how the extended thermodynamics finds it a natural home in the context of quantum field theory. So the details were worked out in a paper with a student, Felipe Rosso, and it came out in June last year. And let's go. So here we go again. Now I write down the metric of a black hole, as we've been doing again and again. This time it's a hyperbolic black hole. Instead of having slices that look like spheres, it's hyperbole instead. It's a hyperbolically sliced ADS is the natural home for these objects. The function V, which really is terrible notation because you're now thinking of volume. I should have used U. Oh well, we won't be using the volume much. Looks like that. And so I have this sort of Pringle chip sort of diagram there to show you it's hyperbolically sliced. And there's some radial function rho, which goes out to infinity, and then the space-time stops at some rho plus. In the case of Cassini, Huerta, and Myers, they were looking at something that really, in some sense, wasn't really a black hole. It's the massless case, in some sense, but that hyperbolically sliced ADS is the case where mu is zero there, and then it really is just ADS in funny coordinates. But the point is that there's a whole family where there's some mu there, and that's a whole family of black holes. We want the whole family for reasons you'll see in a moment. So off we go. I can compute the mass, the entropy, the temperature. I can do the usual things. Just everything we did in the first part, we can do now. I can assign a pressure and a volume. I can compute the volume, and it's the volume you'd expect, although infinite. I can also compute the entropy at any point. I just need to, regularize the appropriate integral. That natural U coordinate I wrote, if I change coordinates, it's basically that same computation again that you use for the entanglement entropy. And indeed, the entropy of this thing, you would naturally conjecture, is the entanglement is like an entanglement entropy. And so here's the picture. So I have, if you like, this is the point, this is the original point at some fixed reference value of the cosmological constant L. Here I am. And that's essentially Cassini, Huerta, and Myers' paper. And the point is that you can, once you extend, work out the extended thermodynamics, and you plot where the M equals zero black holes are, they form a line. In the PV plane, which is natural to draw for the reasons we've been talking about, that looks like this. Now, if you just walked into the room and saw me pointing at a point, you could reconstruct Cassini, Huerta, and Myers at any one of these points. So in some sense, any one of these points is a conformal field theory, and the radius is just given by the L of the pressure that you read off. So the real question then becomes, what happens, what does it mean to move around in this plane? That's the full extended thermodynamics, and that's what we get to give meaning, because although this is a finite temperature story here, moving around in this plane, doing various processes, it corresponds to moving around to different conformal field theories and computing their zero temperature conformal field theories, things like the entanglement entropy. So that's really how the dictionary works. And then it's a matter of just trying to piece together how the whole story fits together to see what it must be telling you about the field theory. And what it's telling you about is points you can reach by RG flow. And so here we go. So let's look at three conformal field theories now, and it's meaningful now to compare them to each other. And so what I can do, for example, it happened again. Sorry, I think either I'm pressing too hard or the key bounces and I go forward a little too much. Okay, yeah. And so I have conformed field theory A, B, and C. And what I can read off at each of these points is a different L, which, naively, you would just go, well, these are just three different conformal field theories at different values of the cosmological constant, which translates into our picture from before, where I have some d-dimensional conformal field theory, and I've just, I've reduced on some ball of radius. Well, I guess in the notation I'm using here, I was using R before, and I'm also using L because L, the length scale associated with the cosmological constant of the dual theory is precisely on the m equals zero curves the same as the radius of the ball. So I'm using L and R interchangeably here. At the level we're working, that's enough. So I have some field theory reduced on the ball of radius R. And so if in principle, then I can compute the entanglement entropy at any of these points and get something rather nice. And I'm going to come up with just give you a name here for this parameter, the ratio of the length scale I might read off for that one compared to that one. So a couple of things I can do. Let's just imagine doing a process that gets me from C to A. Now, in principle, I don't have to go via this path. I could do other paths. But for simplicity, let's just move along the massless curve. So we're doing processes and we're keeping track of all the CFTs along that point. I'll say more about that in a moment. There's a number of different ways of thinking about it. If I think about this as an honest thermodynamic process, well, what's going on is that what would I have to do? I would connect this to some heat bath so that heat can flow out, and I could do a process by which I actually reduce the volume and flow along that path, and that would be a very natural thermodynamic process, which, by the way, is an irreversible thermodynamic process, right? There's some finite heat flow. As I move along here in that language, I can't go backwards, right? In order to go backwards, I would need to connect to a different thermal reservoir in order to have heat flow back in the other direction. So for a given connection to a heat bath to do this process, this is what we learn in undergraduate class is an irreversible process, and that corresponds to the second law of thermodynamics. Well, the really cool thing is that that's precisely mapping to what we would think of as the generalized analogic of C theorem in this setup. And so it stops, in some sense, being an analogy and becomes, because of this map, it becomes a precise connection between the second law of thermodynamics and this generalized C theorem, in the sense that if I keep track of what's going on, I can see, because I can compute the A, you know, the analog of the C function, the theory A versus theory B, C, and I see that it's decreasing, B is less than 1. So really, this really is as though this theory is in the UV and this theory is in the IR, and this process connecting them then is like an RG flow. And if you think about it, the whole business we would do on the field theory side, where we are coarse graining and throwing out degrees of freedom as we move from the UV to the IR, maps precisely to this language where instead I'm coarse graining by essentially reducing my entropy, and the excess entropy, if you like, is in that waste heat that I get when I give up, when I go from here to here. So there's a precise map now between the language of thermodynamics, and in particular the second law of thermodynamics, and the non-decreasing the decreasing of the degrees of freedom as I connect these two field theories. So that's one of the really nice outputs of this. As far as I know, there has never been made a connection between, other than an analogy, between second law of thermo and the C theorem. And now we see that it follows from this map, which is rather nice. A couple of other things you can do with this. I have some extra notes, which I can jump to, actually, in preparation for one last thing I might mention. You can also see that rather than thinking... So the picture is that rather than thinking of this as two different conformal field theories, it's the same conformal field theory, and I've done an RG flow. And there's two ways of thinking about that. One is that I have the ball here, and I read off its radius, and it's at some L I can read off. And then down here, it's at some other L. And so that ball looks like it's a smaller ball. L is smaller, right? And so B is less than 1. But another way of thinking about it is that it's the same size ball, but it looks smaller because I've gone to the infrared, and so I'm now working with longer wavelength physics, and so the ball looks smaller from that perspective. So there's many different ways of thinking about the same thing. Another way of thinking about it is in terms of the cutoff. The cutoff that I used to do the calculation here to compute the entanglement entropy, compared to that, I can write it as the same radius theory, but the cutoff has increased as necessarily it should in terms of a length scale because I've gone to the infrared. So there are many, many different ways of presenting the same picture. So let me see what else I had. I had some words about moving off the M equals zero curve. I think instead, there's a couple of nice things. You can basically rewrite the generalized second law in this language now, and certainly just with P turned off, you can do that story, and that was done in a number of papers, and you can already begin to see the role P would have here. And there's actually a nice paper with Castor and Rob Mann and maybe some others that also begin to work out what this means in the language of the first law of entanglement. But that would then pertain in this picture to how you naturally move off, consider other points beyond just infinitesimal deformations off the M equals zero curve, trying to understand the role of arbitrary mass hyperbolic black holes in this story is something that still should be worked out. And there's some partial work on that. But there's a lot more to be said. So let me not say any more about that. Let you go away and read these. And I'm just going to end with sketching out one last new thing that may be of interest to some of you, which ought to be here. So hopefully, I've convinced you that this is a really interesting outcome. I find it a very satisfying outcome. Once found a very precise use for the extended thermodynamics in this context of quantum information, certainly focusing here on entanglement and deformations thereof if you were to start moving off the curve. But I'd like to say a little bit more about other things you can do as promised in the abstract. So which board? I think I'm done with this, so maybe I could just work in the middle and then everyone be able to see. Anyone? Anyone care? Yeah. No? No one cares. Okay, I'll just work. I just hope everyone can see. Just in case in the questions, maybe I might need it to refer to something. So if everyone can see this, then that's all we need. Here's another really nice thing, and again, if you like, there's something really, really nice one can do, which, again, I think, and I spent a long time thinking about searching the literature. As far as I know, this is quite new, and I would like to understand more about it. There's a thing called the Renyi entropy, which you may know, and it's in some sense the parent. Let's just say it. You can define the Renyi entropy as a sort of generalization. In fact, oftentimes computing the entanglement entropy means that you're first defining the Renyi entropy and then taking the Q. The Q goes to one limit. This is essentially the origin of the famous replica trick that's used a lot in field theory. So Q equals one gives you S1, which is minus trace of rho log rho. And it's a very interesting and natural quantity and has lots of properties, and you can spend a lot of time thinking about it from a quantum field theoretic perspective. And it fits into a large family of deformations, if you like, generalizations of the basic Shannon entropy. And then there's also a whole tradition, it seems, of coming up with cousins of the Renyi entropy. What this setup does, it provides you with a completely physically motivated, in my opinion, new generalization of the Renyi entropy that I feel is good for something. And I just thought I'd throw it out there in case you might use it sometime. So I'll just say, spend a couple of minutes on it because I only have a couple of minutes left. And I'm going to cut to the chase. So I do have a paper on it, which I forgot to write down the reference for, but you can look it up. The key point is the following. There's a way, as far as I know, this observation is due to a conversation on a blog, on John Bias's blog, which he then wrote into an interesting note, and I don't know if that. I think there may be sort of independent ways of arriving at the same thing, but I first learned about it there. 11022098, which I strongly recommend. But there's a different way of presenting this, where it just looks like a quench, in the following sense: you can write this as a difference of free energies. You essentially compute a free energy, which I'll call F at T0. You can compute the same free energy again, but at a different temperature, T0 over Q, and then divide by T0 over T0 over Q, divide by those the temperature difference. And there's a few steps to fill that in to see that that really is the same thing as this. I apologize for being a bit brief. But the really nice thing is that this prescription, you can write this in various ways. You can also write it as 1 over delta t times integral, just an entropy integral. And in fact, in a different paper that I think had its origins here, this is Hung, Myers, Sorkin, I apologize if the person's in the audience. I can't read my own writing. Smolkin, thank you. Smolkin and Yale. And this is 11101084. They essentially did this computation. They basically said, well, look, so they're essentially, from our perspective, they're at this point here. And they just said, well, let's, they don't have the PV, I'm putting that in afterwards. They basically start here on what would be our M equals zero curve. And they say, well, let's just be aware that there's a general entropy function associated with these hyperbolic black holes. So we could actually compute that quantity and just plug that in and use it as a method for generating the Renyi entropy. So they compute it. I won't give you the formula. We don't have time. But it's a thing you can do. And it's useful and interesting. if you take that story and put it into this extended thermodynamic setup, as I did, you find a couple of interesting things. First of all, if you follow the map, right, F is U minus TS, the Higgs free, the Higgs, Helmholtz free energy. If you follow our map, you know that this becomes U plus PV minus TS, and you realize, oh, this is the Gibbs free energy. So we should be working with the Gibbs free energy. Doesn't matter what it's called at this stage, their computation corresponds, because they're at fixed cosmological constant, they don't know about this PV plane, their calculation corresponds to, I'm at some temperature here, T0, and then for positive Q, they go to some other T, T0 over Q, and so they basically do this, and they compute that free energy difference. So essentially, that integral is this line here. Once you do that, you realize, well, clearly, we're missing a trick if that's all we do, right? It's a free energy. A free energy difference is the most natural way of thinking about this. That's a thermodynamic function, so it makes sense to compute differences anywhere on the plane. So in fact, you have a whole family of generalizations, and there's a nice one-parameter generalization, which if I do it right, basically saying instead of just looking at temperature differences, I can also have a pressure difference as well. And if I write my pressure difference in terms of that same parameter B, that RG flow parameter, I can write a generalized Renyi entropy, which depends on, say, Q and B, and you can compute it, and there's a beautiful set of calculations that fall out, beautiful because of the physics, not because of me, that gives you this very natural generalization of the Renyi entropy that I feel is good for something, and it's very naturally suggested by the physics of the extended thermodynamics. There's a number of fun special cases. For example, when this is very vertical, you get the entanglement entropy again. So you can have interesting things where you have one, you fix that to one, and then you have B. There's some interesting, SQ1 would be the usual entanglement entropy. There's a new object here, which, you know, maybe you could give it a name, but it's a thing that you can compute. And then there's a whole two-parameter family that interpolates between the two that has very interesting properties. In view of the time, let me stop there and just invite you to. Oh, right. And there's a story about the holographic heat engines. Let's not worry about it. Let me invite you to think about what this might be useful for this whole framework. Now we've connected these two frameworks. So thanks for listening, and I apologize for running over. Questions? Everything was perfectly clear. Good.
So, I mean, there's this understanding on the M equals zero curve of the C theorem, but you didn't really, unless you deleted it, you had it on the slides, didn't talk about it. I mean, how can one interpret a whole engine cycle in this context?
Very good. Yeah. So, I think there's still something to be understood there, quite a bit to be understood there. I would really like to. So I did have a little bit of a part of the story on here. There's more in the paper, but one of the real questions is. Well, there are two questions. One is, and you know, even before this context, one of the natural things people would ask is, well, how would you ever make such an engine? What does it mean, either in field theory or even in black hole physics, to engineer such a cycle? So one of the things that you might at least try and do is, even if you can't address, for an arbitrary, let's pick a process, for some process, even if you can't necessarily address what it means to visit every point on that, it's nice if you, at least one partial thing that would be nice is if you can write the result of the thermodynamics of doing that process entirely in terms of field theory quantities. So that's one thing we did achieve. There's a very natural family of engines you can define where you move along the m equals zero line and you do this. So for these engines, even though one doesn't have an arbitrary understanding of going arbitrarily far away from m equals zero for everything in terms of field theory, but one knows infinitesimally what those processes kind of want to be. They're either deformations of the ball or the entropy or the state. One can, in those cases, you can write everything for the efficiency of this engine in terms of field theory quantities. So that's a really nice result. And it turns out everything assembles itself into a function of just that RG flow parameter, which is really cute. And the really nice thing is this thing then is bounded by the Carnot engine efficiency. And that Carnot engine efficiency can always be written in terms of 1 minus b, where b is the RG flow parameter, the ratio of those two scales. And the relevant Carnot cycle then is always, you know, obviously it's related to the highest and lowest temperatures of the engine. There they are. You can always write that in terms of some b. So the real take home is that the bound on the Carnot engine is kind of written in terms of the simplest thing you could think of in this conformal field theory context, which is really nice. B is really the only parameter. Okay, it could be B to some power, but you know, it's the simplest power I can think of. And one of the really nice things then is that for an arbitrary engine, anywhere I draw, you know, arbitrarily far away, you know, I may be well completely off the m equals zero curve. Let me put it down here. I didn't draw the diagram big enough, but I can always do the following. I can always relate it to a conformal field theory in the following way. I can always find the lowest TC, which will give me a unique conformal field theory point there. I can always find the TH, and then I know then there's some bound, 1 minus B effective, if you like, which is the B, the ratio of the scales of those two conformal field theories. So that will always be true. And so that's a very general result.
That'll bound the efficiency of that.
And that'll bound the efficiency of that engine. So I think that's kind of an example of what I finally got to grips with working with Felipe, that yes, now I can say engines are bound by this very natural thing which follows from second law of thermodynamics. And the cool thing is, in this context, I can always relate it to two auxiliary conformal field theories that I can locate precisely because I know where these isotherms are. So I think there's a lot more to be understood, because it would still be nice to understand why this bound assembles itself in that way in purely field theoretic terms, but that is, it has to for whatever reason because of the map. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks. Thanks.